This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last night, Governor Phil Scott said he will not cooperate with a federal crackdown on immigration that violates individual rights. This morning, he told VPR why.
I'll stand up for the rights and liberties of all those in our state and the rights of our citizens of the state of Vermont. So we'll continue to uphold the laws of our state and the nation. But we're not going to be forced into taking action that violates our constitutional rights.
His comments come on the heels of the executive order signed by President Trump last week. In response, Scott laid out 5 points of action the state is taking, including looking at the constitutionality of the executive orders, quote, for the purpose of exploring a legal challenge to the orders. He also says he will not comply with any orders that compel state and local officials to carry out immigration enforcement functions. In fact, the governor said he'd look at ways to bar local officials from entering into agreements with the feds on that score either. Today on the program, we're going to look more deeply at the president's actions and how they affect Vermonters. We're going to talk about the reaction of state officials and others to the executive order on immigration, and we're going to put these moves into historical political context. If you have a question on any of those fronts, you can call now 1-800-639-2211. Again, 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm joined today by Leslie Holman, an immigration attorney based in Burlington and former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Hello again, Leslie.
Jane, it's good to be here, even if it's under these circumstances.
James Lyle is executive director of the ACLU of Vermont. He's in our Montpelier studio. Hi, James. Nice to have you on the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Great to be here.
And Matthew Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury. He's in the Middlebury College studio. Matt Dickinson, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you, Jane.
Yeah, it's an interesting time, and I'm pleased to have all three of you here because, you know, different perspectives are helpful in this, I think. Leslie Holman, what do you think of Governor Scott's actions or reaction to President Trump's executive orders?
They're absolutely what they should be. And, you know, it's interesting because the legality of it, clearly, we do not as a state have to and we shouldn't enforce the federal orders. And, you know,
Governor Scott says, you know, this is not the job of the police to enforce immigration laws. The police can carry out all of their functions as police officers without trying to then send the feds immigration status orders.
And that's why if you read the executive order, it actually starts out and says shielding, you know, aliens. They're not shielding. In fact, they're doing what they're supposed to do, but there's certainly no shielding. They're protecting the rights of citizens of the state.
So you appreciate Governor Scott's action?
Absolutely.
James Lyle, what about you? What's your reaction to Governor Scott?
Yeah, I mean, the ACLU commends Governor Scott for his action, and you know, likewise, the Vermont Mayor's Coalition, the Vermont Congressional Delegation, the Attorney General, who's announced a task force to look into what the state and its localities can do in response to the Trump administration's rabidly anti-immigrant agenda. These are encouraging examples of local officials stepping up at a time when some of our most cherished values are under attack. I mean, we're not just talking about the constitutionality of these actions and whether it's good or bad policy. There are obviously major concerns with the constitutionality and the policy decisions. But I think more fundamentally, you know, these early actions by the Trump administration go to the core of who we are as a country, not just as a country that welcomes refugees and immigrants and is a nation of immigrants, but also one that doesn't pick and choose which religion to favor or disfavor. I mean, that's just a core Civics 101 First Amendment issue. And, you know, the Trump administration so far is failing Civics 101. So I think the response is appropriate and we're going to need a lot more of it.
We've heard from Representative Welch that he says this is a Muslim ban. Others have said that. The president has said it's not. It seems crafted to specifically not be what could be legally considered a Muslim ban. James Lyle, do you think it is one?
Well, you know, during the campaign, he said he was going to create a Muslim ban. So I don't think there's any question that that's what they're doing. They're, as I said, targeting one religion for disparate treatment at the same time that he's holding up Christian refugees for different treatment. That is just fundamentally wrong as a matter of constitutional law, just basic constitutional principles, but also, you know, really offends our values as an inclusive, diverse society. And I think that's why you're seeing such a strong reaction, not just from local officials, not just from the ACLU, but from people across the political spectrum and people all over the country who showed up this weekend in airports and cities to protest everything that was wrong about this order and, you know, the orders that preceded it. It was all part of a broader anti-immigrant agenda that was promised and is now being pursued. And as I say, the initiative announced by Governor Scott is to be commended, but we have a lot of work to do, and we're looking forward to working with state officials to do everything we can to counter that agenda.
Professor Dickinson, can you put President Trump's fast and furious executive orders into historical context? Is it unusual to see this much action this quickly?
It's not as unusual as you might think. There's been a lot of focus on executive orders, but keep in mind much of what he's done in his first 10 days involves other policy mechanisms, executive memorandums, presidential directives, and so on, which have the force of law but don't fall in the category of executive orders. And what you see, most incoming administrations, particularly when they're following an administration of the opposite party, will use these type of directives to pick low-hanging fruit, that is, to reverse the most easily reversible actions by predecessors, but also to signal to their constituents that they are moving quickly to fulfill campaign promises. And so I think one of the important things to look at is the actual impact of much of what Trump has said he will do is far less than you might think based on the political controversy. But symbolically, it's hugely important, both for those who want to oppose his presidency, but also for his supporters looking for signs that he is following through on campaign promises.
Well, something like, for example, the executive order that that dealt with the building a wall, the border fence between Mexico and the United States, you know, that didn't actually put any shovels in the ground. Is the executive order on immigration and refugees different because it went into effect immediately and wasn't talked through with other other agencies and the people who would actually have to carry out that executive order?
Well, you raise a good point. So substantively, its impact is probably immediately going to be less than you might think from the hue and cry, although if you're one of those individuals stuck in an airport, that hardly matters to you. The bigger issue here is what it reveals about the process of putting together these directives. There obviously was no central clearance. The implementation of this was botched. Second, it pushes the Trump administration into this polarized situation much more quickly than I think they wanted to. But third, the most important thing to look at here is not simply the opposition from people like Peter Welch, but from members of his own party like Phil Scott. And what I'm really interested in at the national level, how many Republican senators and representatives in Congress are going to get on board with this? Right now, they're very lukewarm towards it, and that's a potential warning sign for Trump.
Listeners, you can share your thoughts with us, your questions. We're getting a broad perspective here on what's happening with the president's order and also looking at different aspects of it and how it affects Vermonters. Our number, again, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Leslie Holman, you're coming from the immigration lawyer perspective here. Do you agree with Professor Dickinson that the actual effect of this order, barring people from seven countries and suspending our refugee program for 3 months or 4 months, doesn't have a huge effect?
Actually, I think that the fallout is so much bigger than people realize and see because, you know, the people at the border that you're seeing at the airport's clearly visible. But there's other things that have already been put in place. All the applications, it's called the I applications, forms, everything's a number, have been suspended for people who are of the seven designated countries. Visa issuance has been suspended for people of the seven countries. And so you're starting to see immediately that even not just the people that are on their way here, but that are going to do things when they're here are affected. I mean, the tentacles are huge. And I agree when they said, there was no planning. I mean, I really think it was irresponsible in the way that this was carried out.
But again, I mean, these seven countries represent a very small fraction of the people who are coming in on these visas, right?
Yes, but, you know, the order was really unartfully written. For example, I mean, lawyers or wordsmiths, And instead, normally when you read things about immigration, it'll say, well, a citizen of this. The order said from. What does that mean? You know, people who are from, are they a citizen? Are they a national? Did they just go there to visit? And, you know, these are the things that we don't know how that's going to play out. And every day the landscape's changing. So it really is much bigger than that, than the little piece.
We got a note from Mike New in Human Resources and Administrative Services at St. Michael's College, and he says, I moderated a meeting here on campus yesterday for our international students and faculty and staff on Trump's executive order. I pulled together a number of people quickly over the weekend as we wanted to show our support and provide information to the members of our community who could be impacted. We tried to provide as much information as we could, understanding that it seemed things were changing hourly. While the executive order covers these seven countries, I was struck, Mike says, by the overall fear of many of our foreign nationals who, per the order, should have no worry. But I understand because of the general tenor of things out of Washington regarding immigration. He says, I got a call late yesterday from a faculty member who's been in the U.S. for 40-plus years, here on a green card, and from one of the seven countries, who was actually concerned about taking a domestic flight. That really hit me. So, Leslie Holman, that goes to your point of broader implications that perhaps people from other countries who are here on green cards or visas may also be concerned.
No question about it. And also, there's terms in there. You know, when you deal with immigration, there's huge discretion on the parts of the agencies. So they've used terms for not just entrance and exit, but what they're going to do with people who are here. You know, right now we're talking about entering, but we've got people, are they going to be enforcement priorities? And we don't know how they're going to interpret these terms. And what one of the most difficult jobs for an immigration attorney is figuring out what's going to happen. We don't have any definition. So, you know, right away, this is not just limited to the people of the seven countries.
Professor Dickinson, the president's actions and the negative response, the people who are opposed to his actions, protests and rallies, it seems to me this is really sucking up all of the oxygen in the room right now. You know, what is the president doing and what are people who are opposed to him, civilians even, doing in response? But the president has said he's confident that the American public at large will support his immigration policy, including building a wall with Mexico. Is there any way to actually gauge the reaction across the country to these executive actions and executive orders? Because it's hard to tell. Are there more supporters out there than people realize? Are there fewer? I mean, do you have any sense of that?
The immediate context, there has been a lot of survey data, and that's one thing we'll look at is survey data. There was some preliminary survey data about 2 weeks ago that showed, you know, slight plurality supporting some of the statements Trump had made, but that was before the hue and cry. And what you see when these incidents happen is that elites on both sides line up to make their case for and against the particular policy, in this case the executive order. And from that, the rank-and-file voters, Joe and Jane Sixpack, then begin to formulate their positions. And a lot of this is going to be sorted through a partisan prism. So that's why I'm really interested, not so much on the reaction of the Peter Welch's of the world, but the Republican Party establishment. If they come out against this en masse, then that's going to signal to a lot of potential Trump supporters that, hey, this is probably not the way to get this administration off on a good footing, and he may reconsider this. Remember, these are all temporary guidelines. We don't know, again, after the 90-day and the 120-day period is up, what the next step is going to be. So the reaction politically from both sides of the political aisle is really important over the next 3 months.
But given how swift the reaction was over the weekend from people gathering at airports and politicians on the Democratic side, in many cases, rushing to be there, we didn't see that from a lot of high-profile Republican politicians. I mean, wasn't that the time to say, no, 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 no?
Well, yes, but you didn't see them rushing to the barricades and saying, he's my president and I'm behind him 100% either. They're laying low, I think, a good chunk of them, and trying to figure this out. And again, I think Leslie's point about how poorly articulated this policy was and the amount of discretion that's left for some of the border guards. I mean, Reince Priebus on the Sunday talk shows walked back some of the notion that green card holders, for instance, would be affected by this. So there's a lot of this that still has to play out, and that makes it very difficult to figure out what public opinion is going to be.
We got a note from a listener going as No Meat, Bare Feet, who says, can someone clarify and explain the difference between Trump's executive order and Obama's 2011 immigration suspension? If we're going to be angry, then we need the facts clearly and succinctly explained. James Lyle, is this something you can explain? A lot of people have been talking about these seven countries, for example, were ones that were recognized by the Obama administration as countries to keep an eye on. So what about the immigration suspension of 2011?
I think a number of people have pointed out multiple differences between Obama's actions and these executive orders. I mean, the most fundamental being that that was not a ban. It was in response to specific information. They actually increased screening protocol in response to it. There's a long list of differences. And the fact that this has been held out as essentially the top line defense of this program to essentially try and blame it on Barack Obama, I think speaks to the indefensibility of this executive order, if that's really the best that they can come up with. They're not trying to defend or at least going into much detail about the constitutionality. All of the attacks from foreign policy establishment leaders from both sides of the aisle, I think the fact that they're relying on the fact that Barack Obama started it, the justification, is telling.
We're talking today about what President Trump's executive order on immigration and refugees means for Vermonters and what the reaction has been like. EAC says, cheers to Governor Scott on his Vermont guts. Let's continue our independent anti-slavery heritage. Be the great little state that opens our gate to all who seek freedom. You can share what you're thinking or any questions that you have about the politics of this, about actual policy on immigration. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. When we come back, we're going to hear from someone who's been stuck in one of the seven countries on the list, trying to figure out what he should do, lives in the United States, but is a citizen of Iran. We're going to talk about that and hear more of your questions and calls. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at how the president's executive order on immigration and refugees has been interpreted, protested, and internalized in Vermont. And we're getting questions and thoughts from you on the politics and the effect of this order on your own lives. If you have a question, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or maybe you'd like to share a story about how this affects you for better or for worse. Interested in hearing all opinions here. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Also joining us now on the line, in addition to the guests that we have today, is Atta Anzali. He's an assistant professor of religion at Middlebury College and an Iranian citizen with a green card. He's been in Iran on sabbatical doing research, and he's now dealing with the issue of when to return to the United States with his wife and children. Professor Anzali, thank you very much for joining us from Iran. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me.
You were set to arrive in the United States, I believe, on Sunday, and you just decided when you started hearing about what was happening in the United States not to travel. Can you tell me about that decision?
Yes, we had booked tickets for Sunday, and as the news basically leaked of the executive order of the president, we got really worried. And just, I think it was 9 hours before our flight that we got the news that the secretary or, you know, someone from the Department of Homeland Security has declared that this ban includes green card holders. So we basically canceled our flight because we didn't want to be detained or deported at the border. And that was the situation, basically.
I understand you have two small children and they would be traveling with you. Was that mm-hmm. part of your decision making on, you know, what you wanted your children to experience?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have two daughters. One of them is 12 years old and the other one 9 years old. Both of them have spent most of their life in the United States. And actually, the younger one is a citizen. And we didn't want them to go through the experience of like being detained or deported, possibly. So we decided, in consultation with the college, and the lawyers that this was the best course of action to take, basically to wait and see, because the situation honestly is very fluid, and you know, like every day we were hearing something else from the administration, so we weren't really sure what is going to happen when we arrive at the border.
What's your plan now?
So I've been talking to my immigration lawyer, and actually, I believe Leslie Holman was on your program.
Yes, still is. She's sitting right in front of me.
Hi, Atta.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, so we had a long conversation with her, and I also talked to the college president and people involved there. And we basically decided that at this point, probably the least risky option for us would be to return back before the stay order in Boston expires. So our current plan is to fly back to Vermont or to Boston on Friday because we are not sure really what is going to happen in the future.
How does this all make you feel, Professor Anzali?
Let me put it this way. This is like what is happening to me. On the one hand, you know, the reason why I chose to stay in the United States after I got my PhD from Rice University was I thought I would have a better chance of doing what I want to do. My research is on Islamic studies. I teach about the Muslim world to my students. And as you know, religion is a highly politicized and sensitive issue in Iran. So my impression was that I would have a better time and a better opportunity to teach freely and do research and educate in the United States. So that was the basic reason why we chose to immigrate to the United States. And now, look, now after hearing something like this, a ban like this, it's really disappointing for us when we think about a country that prides itself in, you know, like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, to create such a situation where, I mean, there are so many people in much worse condition. I have colleagues who actually can't go back to Iran because the government in Iran will detain them if they go. And they can't come to the U.S. because actually this is going to happen to them probably here too. So it's a really confusing and disappointing situation to be at. I mean, that this is beyond just, I mean, of course, I think about my kids, I think about my wife. I think about my family, but this is also something about my what I do. You know, I think I'm contributing to this society. I educate the students about the Muslim world. You know, like I help them understand what is going on. We talk about all these global issues, but you know, when a ban like this comes and cuts you off, it's like then you try. You know, kind of then think about. Where you really live and what people want from you or the expectations. I it's just really confusing for us at this moment.
It must be confusing for your daughters too. What are they asking you?
Of course, I mean it's very. My older daughter is, you know, like has gone through the whole elementary school, you know, like from when she was first year, she was 1 year old when we came here. So she identifies fully as an American. And she was very upset when we shared the news with her that there's such a ban. And she, you know, like she shared her frustration and her emotions in a kind of small piece that I shared on Facebook, and basically there she is saying, you know, like why the people, you know, like what is the difference between me and my classmate, you know, like we have laughed together, we have played together, and now just because I'm different in terms of my origin or my faith, I'm not able to come back to the same school that I've been going and not able to join the same community.
Can I ask you one other question, Professor?
Sure.
What are you hearing from your peers and friends and family in Iran. What's the reaction in Iran like to this executive order in the United States?
Well, you know, like more than actually, I think the reaction here is mostly not just to the executive order, but the way the administration is going back and forth and, you know, saying, sending different signals. People can't believe their eyes in terms of, you know, because kind of the impression in the public, you know, in Iran, you know, usually people here have a very positive image of the American society and how it works. And now they're kind of really flabbergasted when they see, you know, like one day there is something and then next day there is something else. And it's just such a fluid situation with the government. And they start thinking about, you know, like what is going on in a country where they thought it's basically the rule of law and there's like everything would be calculated and that kind of, you know, like a very disciplined way of governance and civic society. So it's a lot of confusion, I think. You know, people can't, they can't understand what is happening. It's very confusing to them as well.
Atta Anzali is an assistant professor of religion at Middlebury College. He's an Iranian citizen with a green card and is currently in Iran trying to get back. Atta Anzali, thank you very much for talking with us and safe travels at the end of the week.
Thank you so much.
We're talking about immigration today. There you have it, one Vermont resident who's certainly been affected by the executive order. Listeners, if you have an experience you'd like to share or a question, you can post it on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. Before we get back to our guests here, let's take a couple of your calls and comments. PRH says, I'm mildly encouraged by the governor's stand so far, but we all have to remember that Donald Trump is a bully who's been taught that if someone hits you, you hit back 10 times as hard, and he seems to have no qualms about doing so. I hope the governor is prepared to stand up to that kind of response. Let's go to Paula calling in from Enosburg Falls. Hi, Paula. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was just responding to the question about how much influence does this. This is just seven countries and relatively few numbers of people are being affected. And I wanted to say I think the effect of this is very, very much greater in our country and in the world than just the numbers of the people from those countries. I'm an American citizen. My father worked in the State Department, and I grew up partly in Kenya and India, and I grew up with the experience of going to school and having friends that were Muslim and Hindu and all kinds of religions, and totally familiar with the idea that, you know, we're all kind of we have so much in common. So to hear the Iranian professor talk about his daughters being sort of bewildered by this and why should they be picked out and so on, I think this particular attempt to pick these seven countries is maybe just a foot in the door, and that I'm very worried that it's just going to get extended in many ways and be much more a Muslim ban that Trump wanted. And I think it has I don't think it does help our security. The people that are coming over, I mean, I know how hard it is for people to apply for, to get visas to come and to get green cards, and they go through a lot, and they are extremely vetted already. I feel so bad for the Syrian families that aren't able to come to Rutland, because I'm sure they've been through a lot, and some of these families have been through years of interviews. So it's not really a security thing. It's kind of like a propaganda thing, and it has a very bad effect because it affects universities, professors, researchers, people in business, sports figures in the States that have dual citizenship. They don't know their famous sports figures in football and basketball. There's politicians that can no longer travel freely. I know there's a parliamentarian in Britain that is afraid to come to the States because he has dual citizenship with Sudan. So, I mean, the whole thing to me is rather absurd and very, very scary. And I just wanted to make that comment that I think it has a huge... People in other countries are scratching their heads, and I think we're really losing faith.
Yeah, Paula, I hear your comments and I appreciate them, and I can hear the energy in your voice and how you're feeling about this. Let me get another call in from Julia in Rutland. Julia, what are you thinking?
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, certainly.
Okay, great. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead, Julia. What's on your mind?
You sounded a little faint. Anyway, thank you for taking this call. I want to second what the caller just said. This has far-reaching consequences. It's not going to affect just, you know, these particular groups of people. I happened to read the text of the order, which is published on FoxNews.com in its entirety. And in the little time I had, several things just jumped out at me. One is that Trump is empowering all local and state law enforcement officers to do the same function as immigration officers. He's calling for immediate and summary deportation of people who are tagged as being a danger to society. He's removing all the guarantees about the privacy of personal information. He's removing all of those from people who are identified as potential dangers, and he's threatening any country that doesn't want to take these people back, they're going to suffer sanctions from the United States. And then finally, there is no recourse. In other words, you know, there was a big hold harmless clause at the very end of it that said, you know, nothing that we do to you, you will have no recourse at all. So, you know, this is. It almost sets up a police state that's, and going into the prisons and examining people's backgrounds, even down to misdemeanors. It's a police state that's being set up, and like the caller just said, I'm afraid it's a foot in the door, and it's something that will involve all of us one way or the other.
Julia, thanks for your comments. Appreciate hearing from you. Russell says, I don't see the ban on these countries as bad because of what people look like or who they are or their religious affiliation. It's because these are hot spots with a lot of turmoil. I'd like to see it very strictly looked at before opening it back up. We're talking today about immigration. We're going to take a very quick break and then come back with our guests, Leslie Holman, James Lyle, and Matt Dickinson, and have more of your thoughts and questions. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Leslie Holman is an immigration attorney based in Burlington. James Lyle is executive director of the ACLU of Vermont. Matt Dickinson is a professor of political science at Middlebury College. They are with us today talking about the immigration order that was signed by the president last week, and we're looking at how Vermonters are affected by this. Excuse me, this cold will not go away. Listeners, if you have a question or a remedy, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to John calling in from Rochester. John, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, I hear you. Go right ahead.
My question in all this, or my dismay in all this, is that the Democratic Party seems to have disappeared since the election. Whatever protests there are don't seem to have anything to do with what the Democrats do, and there's still the opposition party here. It's very disturbing to me.
So you'd like to see more of a push from Democrats?
There doesn't seem to be a spokesman. The president finally came out, and Obama came out and said that people were doing the right thing. But even though she lost, Hillary Clinton still has a voice. Is there no leadership in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, John. Thanks for your point. We're going to get one more in here from Herman in South Hero. Herman, go right ahead. Herman, turn down your radio. It's a couple of seconds behind, and you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Good afternoon.
Herman, turn down your radio.
How about it's off? Hello?
Hi, Herman.
Can
we got you. Yeah, we can hear you. Turn down your radio and go right ahead with your comment.
Well, my comment is that, and I agree with all the statements about how negative impact all this is having on our country's our friends and allies, but no one's actually talking about how futile this is actually for saving us from terrorists. From what I heard from all the experts, it really doesn't do anything to protect us, and it looks like it's more of a smokescreen for him to say, I'm doing something. The president is saying he's doing something to protect our country, but it looks like he's just keeping his promise of keeping Muslims out.
Herman, thanks for your comments. James Lyle, what do you say? Do you see any national security benefit to this executive order?
I think he brings up an important point. I mean, despite our proud traditions of welcoming immigrants to this country, the scapegoating of vulnerable populations for political gain is unfortunately nothing new. And as in past eras, when xenophobia and nativism were rampant, as it happened throughout our history, these latest orders require a very strong response. Multiple people have talked about how this actually damages America's national security. I think those are absolutely valid points.
Leslie Holman, you've been working. We heard from our guest, Atta, that you're a lawyer on his case, and you're working with other people who are going through some concerns or maybe situations like his. What legal outlets are there for help? We're hearing from immigration attorneys offering to work pro bono on cases. What outlets are there?
And you're exactly right. It's been so encouraging to see people coming from everywhere. There's a group in Burlington that apparently is working. I haven't met with them yet. People are reaching out everywhere. And what people should do is either call. They can call us. They can call anyone. You know, they'll be directed to it. You've got different task forces. You've got Migrant Justice. And the other thing that I wanted to say is that, you know, we're seeing people in other states writing to their schools, writing to their hospitals. Another way to help people is to make sure that this doesn't permeate and to keep people here.
Do you think anything is likely to change at our Canadian border right here on the Vermont-Canadian border that people should be aware of?
You know, that's a good question. There's a lot of ambiguity in what's written. And we've been working with, on a national level to see what's going to happen. We don't know. I will tell you there's a piece in the executive order that could shut down our order because it calls for biometrics of people leaving the country. Now, we saw after Witte, we saw after 9/11 that they put in something that was going to include people had to register as they leave and turn in their stuff. They couldn't do it. It was not possible to enforce it.
Turn in their stuff, you mean?
Their cards or their I-94 cards, or at least let the country know that they were leaving. And when someone leaves actually on a plane, the manifest goes right there. They know when people leave. If they're going to ask for biometrics, and if they do what they did now, which is just make it so, if you will. I am a Star Trek fan, so that comes easily. They're not going to be able to do it. You're going to shut down our borders. And, I think also what's happened is the borders is they haven't been given the guidance. So, I think that people don't know what to do. And, the people at the border are law enforcement agencies, and they're going to err on the side of conservatism. And, you may see a very strict change.
Let's go to Jake calling in from Waterbury. Hi, Jake. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right. So my question specifically concerns whether this executive order can be seen as an actual attempt at immigration policy or as the sort of shock point that we've seen some signs that it has been used as. So federal judges handing down orders that have been largely ignored by the enforcers of the policy, by CBP and DHS. Specifically, the Department of Homeland Security very much acting independently of any government oversight beyond the executive branch, and whether we can tell if this executive order of Steve Bannon's, Donald Trump's, is something that is an actual attempt at forging immigration policy or the complete leaving out of any expertise or any information to the branches that it directly affects is indicative of a much more sinister action.
Jake, thanks for the call. Professor Dickinson, let me turn that one over to you.
So the caller raises a good point. We alluded to this earlier, that the Trump administration seems to have ignored processes in place for vetting possible administrative actions like this executive order with the relevant experts in the Department of Homeland Security, in ICE, and so on. Whether that was deliberate or just the function of ignorance, it's hard to say. Whether this represents a change in policy, keep in mind that executive orders have limited capacity to make sustained policy commitments. They can do short things, reallocate money that's already been appropriated, but anything that requires statutory change or runs against existing statute or the spending of money must go through Congress. So, again, I think one of the watchwords here is this is a very fluid situation. It's not clear the Trump administration understood the implementation side of this at all. And part of the feedback or the pushback they're getting is because of that uncertainty over what these directives mean. So even supporters who kind of liked Trump's idea that we need to strengthen our borders are unclear whether this is going to accomplish that or how it's going to accomplish it. And that's a problem.
But Jake sees perhaps something more sinister and a way, an end run around the checks and balances put in place in the Constitution. Do you see that as a possibility? I'm not asking you to you know, weigh in before the fact, but is that a possibility?
Well, there's intent and then there's capability. And even if the intention here was to make policy unilaterally in a system of shared powers, it's very difficult to do. And we're already seeing pushback from three different alternative power centers. The judiciary, which has rendered its own decisions, at least in terms of forcing people to come back, go back from where they came from. The bureaucracy, you know, implementation standards are going to vary. We have federalism, so law enforcement officers may not go along with this. And finally, the big missing piece here is Congress, and particularly the Republicans. And it's very important to see how the Republican Party leadership comes down on this issue, and that shoe has not fallen yet.
Is it unusual to fire an attorney general as the president did last night, even if she was only there temporarily as an Obama administration holdover?
Well, so in the context of which the firing took place, yes, it's quite unusual. On the other hand, this was a political appointee, a holdover from the Obama administration whose days were numbered. So again, the substantive implication, and this comes up again and again, of Trump's actions aren't nearly as important as the perceptions they create more broadly and the political pushback. So Yates' removal is really well within his power, and it would have taken place whether he had fired her or not once Sessions is confirmed, assuming he is as the new attorney general. But the context just provides a little more of a flashpoint, and it galvanizes opposition much more quickly against the Trump administration.
James Lyle, you're the executive director of the ACLU of Vermont. I'm curious what you're thinking of for your organization for next steps and you know, where you go with all of this, given what we've been hearing from Vermonters and the fluid nature of the situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, so one is the ACLU is going to be litigating this and I'm sure related issues related to the executive orders. The case out of Brooklyn that received the most attention over the weekend is ongoing, as are other lawsuits in Washington, California, Pennsylvania, other states around the country. Other organizations have filed similar lawsuits. So the legal challenges will continue and proliferate. It's also really critical to work on the local level and to, you know, to go back to, the piece about so-called sanctuary cities. And I think a caller said that they're, commend, as we do, local officials speaking out against these executive orders, but concerned about the bullying of the Trump administration. And, you know, I think it's an important point. And, you know, we all know how to deal with bullies. You have to stand up to bullies. And the fact is that Donald Trump cannot force localities and states to enforce a mass deportation plan. Congress has never directed the president to defund states and localities that stay clear of deportation. There are a number of provisions in the executive orders that would require legislation. If Congress did enact legislation like that, it would likely be struck down. It would certainly be challenged as unconstitutional because the federal government cannot coerce states to carry out federal policies. That raises federalism issues. We want to work with local governments on all of the things that they can do to respect the constitutional rights of of residents of Vermont, including immigrant residents. And, you know, the good news is the law's on our side, and we don't have to start from scratch. You know, the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council, at the direction of the legislature, has already adopted a fair and impartial policing policy, and that was in consultation with the Attorney General's Office, the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and civil rights and human rights groups like Migrant Justice, the ACLU, and others. So the policies are already there. And, you know, we welcome the governor's statement that he's going to pursue those, as well as the attorney general. We look forward to working on those further at the local level.
That's James Lyle, executive director of the ACLU of Vermont. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We've also been speaking with Matt Dickinson, professor of political science at Middlebury College. Professor Dickinson, thanks to you and thanks to the college for the use of the studio.
Thank you, Jane.
And Leslie Holman is an immigration attorney based in Burlington, former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks very much to you, Leslie.
My pleasure.
More to come on this from VPR as we look at the effect of these orders, and you can stay with us for all of our coverage. One more thing that remains unclear in Washington is how federal funding to states might be affected in the short term and long term by the new administration and congressional action. Tomorrow on this program, we'll get an idea of how much federal funding Vermont receives, where it goes, and what safeguards are in place, at least for the immediate future. Be sure to tune in for that conversation tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.